Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 63 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, we feature the second part of poet Ian Duig's interview with Julia Coppice. Here, Ian speaks with Julia about his use of form, his collaborations with other artists, and the role of poetry in speaking for the oppressed. You can hear the first part of the interview in episode 58.
You don't, Ian, shy away from presenting difficult situations to your readers, whether you do that via humour or in other ways. And that leads me on to a sonnet of yours, Civilization, from your 2007 collection, The Speed of Dark, in which you write, "Poets do sometimes stand up to wrong, if not as often as we like to think." So your poem is a sort of modern-day riff on Shakespeare's famous sonnet 116, "Let us not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments." And this is another poem that addresses a serious topic, and it's a topic that's very much in the news at the moment, that of gay marriage. And there's an unmistakable undertow of anger in the poem for me, an anger expressed on behalf of a minority group. And I know, as you've said, that you spent some years working with homeless people and people with addictions, people who might be said to be on the margins of society in some way. Has that experience fed into your writing? And how often is anger a motivating force in your work?
Well, it's a lot, really, probably too much. It does get in the way sometimes. It is, for me, the whole issue of communication and poetry are bound up in politics and morals and ethics and all the rest of it, and how you speak, who you speak for, who gets to speak, who gets to listen. In the book it appeared in, I have a lot of things which are sympathetic to the situation that the Muslim communities find themselves in Britain at the time. But sometimes you do have to face up to the fact that, like, you know, the Muslim community, Christian community, very often have pretty benighted aspects of their behaviour and character when it comes to sort of recognising the importance of sexual love between men and women in their own gender. And it's not that people can't do it. We were talking earlier on about what people don't know. And there's a difference to me, it seems, between what they don't want to know. Things that are just uncomfortable. Things that people turn away from. And that makes me angry. It's like, I can't believe that it is now regarded as sinful to understand the point of view of other people. Do you remember that woman, Jenny Tong, was thrown off the front bench of the Liberals because she could understand how some Palestinians became suicide bombers? Now, it seems to me the first thing you have to do if you're going to move past any of these situations is understand them. How can it possibly be the case that gay marriage is an issue? Now, the Archbishop of Canterbury in the past couple of days was talking about the fact that, you know, if the elements within the Church of England push gay marriage, it will mean people are killed in Africa. Now, this is the same Church of England that have contained within their ranks a bishop, I think, who was suspected involvement with the Rwandan genocide. It's like, excuse me, can you just turn to one side and look at what you're already doing? And it seems to me enormously mealy-mouthed. I feel that you should say, well, there it is. Men love men, women love women. Get over it, you know, move on. Working in the Middle Ages, it was like usury was the big thing. That was the big sin that obsessed the Christian church, usury. Mm. Well, the Western world had certainly finessed that by the Renaissance, you know. Things which seem incredibly important in a particular age in a religion, a couple of centuries, no one even talks about it anymore.
It's interesting that you tell that story about the bishop, because in the poem, Civilization, the anger takes on a very audible form. It becomes very easy to hear in the lines, "Love is not love that alteration finds for bishops, governors or presidents." And those strong plosives, the b, g, p, sound like you're spitting out the job titles of bishops, governors and presidents, as if you find it distasteful to have them in your mouth for too long.
Well, it was like the governor, of course, has changed his attitude. It was Arnie Schwarzenegger at the time when he was governor of California. He was, at that stage, he's changed his tack since, but he was saying that it would be, that wouldn't happen in California. Can't remember which bishop it was, but there were specific people I had in mind.
Oh, yes. But the anger comes across so clearly in the sound of the words and the contrast with the line before, the sort of liquid L of love, which is repeated. So very controlled, but definitely angry and also gently subversive. I'm surprised, in fact, that it hasn't been taken up as a civil rights anthem yet. Perhaps it will be. But it ends with a final clinching and strongly rhyming couplet, which is such a hallmark of Shakespeare's sonnets. Would you read the last six lines of this poem out for us?
I stretch the metre of an antique song that your true right may shine through my dull ink. For poets sometimes do stand up to wrong, if not as often as we like to think. But if I lie, then Shakespeare couldn't scan. No woman, woman loved, nor man loved man.
So the poem's written in sonnet form to respond to Shakespeare's original. But I wonder if we can take a step back from specific poems at this point, just to talk a little bit more generally about your use of form and about musical forms too. So you talk in this poem about stretching the metre of an antique song for your own ends, the antique song being in this instance the Shakespearean sonnet. But elsewhere you use ballads, folk songs, rhyming couplets, rhyming quatrains, free verse. Form is clearly important to you. And I know that you've often collaborated with musicians too and explore musical forms. Could you perhaps describe one of those projects to us and tell us what it is that draws you to working with musicians?
Well, I'm working with artists at the moment as well. I suppose with musicians and with artists, it's like their job begins where mine ends in a certain way. And I suppose one of the things which I find endlessly fascinating about language is that it pulls in completely contradictory directions. There is what the words mean, literally, which you can put together in interesting ways, so they mean more than one thing. But then there's just the music of the language itself. When I was working on the Fauvel cycle, I looked a lot at medieval musical notation, because it was, you know, it made a huge difference. Once you could write down music, it has a completely different existence. Mm. You know, somewhere it's recorded. And the difference that made to music in the medieval period was really huge, you know. And it's in that area where, beyond the words, your mind is looking into silence and finding something musical in that silence, looking at the white page, perhaps imagining that white page having a more dynamic relationship to the words. You know, like Barbara Guest, the New York school poet, the future writ in white spaces, that line. And it's like the white spaces on the page and the death that we're all heading towards. Mm-hmm. I just find that absolutely fascinating, where one idea breaks off and another one begins, where one medium breaks off and another one begins. And the point at which they bleed into each other, I find fascinating. I think maybe that's something in my mind as a contemporary writer, locating poetry where it exists in its different state nowadays from where it existed in the past. I think it's more free-floating than it used to be. So one of the things that I've been working with is Christopher Fox, who has done something about the people who built the motorways. I wrote this long ballad about a singer called Dearc O'Cahoyne, great Irish singer of Shadnose traditional music, who came to Leeds with the road builders. As I got interested in the whole thing, it was like a road is separate. A road is separate from the place it goes through. I mean, the whole point of a road is that it's the gap between houses. It's part of a journey. It's like a form of a poem. Anything can occupy that road and go in a particular way. Anything can occupy a particular form. There are available options for a journey.
Say a bit more about that. Anything can occupy a particular form.
Like the Shakespearean thing earlier on, I was doing it very obviously to draw attention to the fact that this is hardly a new thing that people are talking about, and that it didn't seem to have been as much of an issue in Shakespeare's day. So it's certainly not new. One of the other things I looked at is Enkidu, the lament for Enkidu, but I didn't think people would know that. I thought Shakespeare is a form where I think, you know, everybody has a vague sense of the sonnet in their mind. I wanted people to read this at their weddings, which is what they did. Mm. I wanted it to have a kind of civic, emotional role.
I expect it's having something of a resurgence at the moment.
Well, it might be doing. But people did read it at a lot of weddings, and it was very moving.
Yeah.
So the thing about, like, music and form is I used a form for this singer. I used the fact that when the roads are laid, they get old books, to guarantee silence, to put under the roads so that there will be silence.
It's an amazing image.
That's an extraordinary image, it seems to me.
Books underneath the...
Yeah, pulped books underneath, between where the roadbed is and the asphalt that goes on top. That's pulped books go there. And they still do it. They've been doing it for a long time. The sort of joke within the sort of motorway building sort of industry is that Mills and Boone are better because they're slushier. You know, they get a better seal, but that is just...
What you're describing is a very specific way or order of working. Have you ever worked the other way around, where you're given music and asked to set words?
Yes. The Speed of Dark was largely written around a commission from the Clarks group for the Fauvel cycle, which is early 14th century. Now, I mean, that was interesting in some ways, in as much as some of the tunes that I wrote the words for had to fit those tunes. Mm. Although the singers were actually extraordinarily talented. They didn't really... Considering the fact that there were motets, so at a first rehearsal, not only would you be singing words that you were unfamiliar with, you'd be singing at the same time as the person next to you was singing different words. It's just amazing technical ability, you know. So they would be, like, the words had to be syllable, rhythm, hit on the note. I did a religious piece, which was virtually a translation. The only thing that I tend to do differently in these translations, particularly from the Latin, if it's medieval, I tend to regularise the rhythm, because in those days a set rhythm was regarded as secular.
Right.
And impure, almost. And that there would be more fugitive rhythms for the more spiritual material. Whereas I think to the modern ear...
Yeah.
People expect hymns to be regular rather than... I don't think they will hear...
Very much so, I think, yeah.
Yes, irregularity in that way. So I've adopted it for that reason.
And do you have a preference at all for one of those ways of working? I mean, they are quite different things, aren't they?
They are. It's easier. If you just got to fill in words that, you know, like the last one was the dismissal from the Mass. It's an anonymous dismissal from the Mass. So that all of the lines were eight syllables and I ate the four stresses.
So you find that working to form...
Yeah, that's it. It's a bit like filling in a crossword to a certain extent. You know, there are only a limited number. I mean, there's not one right answer, but there's only a limited number of answers that you can put in. In one of the medieval notation systems, it generated all your words, you know, because certain consonants sound better. If you use this table, you could generate your next verse. It was almost like a computer program.
How amazing.
It was the most extraordinary thing. Really, really interesting.
So we've talked about the forms that you write in and why you use particular forms. Thinking about the mechanics of the way you compose, do you prefer to write on screen or on paper? How does that work?
Well, most of my writing now, I do write a lot on sort of journeys I take out. The most convenient way for me to get things down in the form that I can then read them later on is if I use my mobile phone. I've got a small laptop as well, but the mobile phone is big enough for me.
You mean because of your handwriting? You literally wouldn't be able to read it.
Well, my handwriting is terrible. Right. I mean, it must be the... I mean, I know it's like a doctor's thing, but poets are terrible. I remember George Macbeth. His handwriting was so bad that when he submitted his finals, they made him sit in a room and translate it so that they could mark it, you know. And mine wasn't quite as bad as that in public exams. But if I write something when I'm out, I can't guarantee that I can read it, particularly if I change things. Mm. If I write little bits over the top and, you know, and then it's
just
gone.
It becomes a school.
Yeah, and then if later on I want to sort of go back through my drafts, I've no idea what they were saying when I first started out. So
the advantage you use screens.
I use screens. It's convenient. You can read it pretty easily.
Yeah.
I mean, the advantage, I'm not trying to advertise Google Docs, but I use them because one thing which is really good is you can see your revision history. You know, so if I'm out and I have my phone, I go onto Google Docs, I can call up every change I've made to a poem, however long I've been working on it.
Because that's the thing lots of people don't like about working on screen is that, you know, once a line's deleted, it's deleted, and you can't remember what your first draft was.
All right, that's not the case with Google Docs. Mm. I mean, all of the changes you've ever made are there. And the advantage for that is that if I have access to the internet, I have access not only to everything I'm working on, but like most of the complete manuscript of earlier books as well. Mm. But in a poem, it's all there. You can see, depending on how you want to call it up, you can see the changes you've made, or you can just go back to the original version. Losing manuscripts, you know, and like Brendan Behan lost his translation of the Midnight Courts, you know, Courts and Varnia, one of the great works in the Irish language. And that's it. You know, there's no calling up earlier drafts. It's now gone forever.
What about when it comes to handing on papers, as I believe you've done recently, to archives, university archives, and there's just bound to be less stuff?
Yes, that is a problem at the moment. I mean, I was surprised that that should be an issue. I mean, I agreed to give my papers, or to sell, to be honest, my papers to the University of Leeds. But I didn't have a lot of handwritten drafts to give them, and it was one of the things they were very disappointed about. I had some versions from quite some interesting letters, but the idea that you can, you know, people can work through all the drafts of a poem, and I'm sure in the generation's time, people will look back on those days as I look back on before they had musical notation, you know, that this extraordinary time and the most bizarre lengths had to be gone to record how a poem developed. I mean, that will all be gone in a single generation, but we're in that generation.
But there are wonderful books that have been published recently, like I'm thinking of Sylvia Plath's Ariel, where Faber brought out the book with various drafts that she'd been through. They seem more and more precious these days because of the rarity of them.
Yeah, that's it. They are literally becoming more precious because they are becoming rarer, you know. I mean, the way that you can now call up images, I remember like when Faber brought out The Wasteland. Mm. I really like that, the way you can sort of call up the history of the text. And in a strange way, it makes it more medieval. It turns the screen into a palimpsest. The screen is more like a scroll than a codex anyway, very often when you're looking through it. So we're looking at forms of physical forms of recording lettering that, you know, go back over 1,000 years. You know, mixed with this ultra-modern way of producing language.
That's interesting. Now, thinking again about the cultural references and the sheer number and variety in your work, which we suggested some people may find intimidating or frustrating or obfuscating or in some way off-putting, some readers, I suspect, won't get many of the references in your work. Can you just respond to that?
I think I've always accepted that I was never going to have a huge readership. I know that in some of the things that I'm interested in, I have in jokes that very few people will get. But the pleasure I get from that is that when the person who does get it gets it, they will really enjoy it, you know. I remember working with on an opera setting, and we were talking about, you know, what the audience are likely to be able to hear from what you write, and he was saying that like 40 to 60% as you go along, words that they're unfamiliar with, And for a first reading of a poem, I think it's probably something like that too, you know. And then I think if you go back to it and you see the patterning that has been put in place, if it's a person who knows what they're doing, they will draw attention to particular pieces of information to make you realise that there is something going on there. And I try and do that.
And that those parts are important. There are ways of highlighting.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Okay, so to give an example from your work, your poem Goths, for instance, which is another of my favourites, contains a couple of references that I didn't get. I knew, for instance, that Whitby is a place of pilgrimage for Goths because the Dracula film or part of it was made there. And Dracula is part of British culture. But you also reference the film Ringu, which is a Japanese horror film, which I hadn't heard of, and which might be considered more obscure, although presumably it's fairly well known among the Goth community.
It is. It's also one of these things, it's a generational thing.
Uh-huh.
I mean, from our generation, and I'm older than you, Japanese horror would be regarded as a very obscure subject. Hardly anybody knew Japanese horror films. But Asian horror has been very big in the past 20 or 30 years, and the new school of Japanese horror. One of the great pleasures, my son is not terribly interested in poetry, by which he has no interest whatsoever in poetry, but he is very interested in film, and we watch film from all over the world, and he's not at all bothered by subtitles. And I think that is a generational thing, that they are able to consume visual media for other cultures and music from all over the world in a way that we didn't. So I think in his generation, that film is almost a cliche.
Oh, right.
There are particular bits in it, and the girl with the long hair
yeah.
coming towards you in the film. It's a great film, you
is
must say.
Is that Sadako?
Yeah, and the way she looks like a goth, but that is the central chilling passage in the film. Spoilers. So, spoiler alert there, I won't tell you anything else, but that's a very well-known film in this generation.
Okay, but even if it weren't, I mean, for me, I didn't know about it. It didn't mar my enjoyment or appreciation or even understanding of the poem at all. But what I like most about the poem, I think, is its tone, the sort of mixture of irony and affection. It's sort of gently mocking, I think, but it doesn't demean its subject. I think the Goths come out of it fairly well. And when I read the poem again, I find myself respecting the Goths and that kind of strange, unhealthy lifestyle they have, purely because I think they've been so vividly put before us. But there is a tinge of irony, I think, isn't there? The poem opens, Goths, I love them. They bring a little anti-life and uncolour to the corn exchange on city centre shopping days. Did you have, when you were writing about the subject, did you have a particular take?
It was, and indeed that start that you sort of put out really locates it. It was, they were all banned. They used to meet in front of the corn exchange. It was opposite a lot of the charity shops, which the Goths used to go to, like Oxfam, have special nights for sort of Goths where they sell all the long black clothes and things like this. And West Yorkshire was a real area for it, but, you know, they would come from Bradford and Sheffield and gather outside the Corn Exchange. But it was because the people who owned the Corn Exchange wanted to go a bit more upmarket. They had all the Goths moved on. And I suppose generally Goths are amongst the most despised of the youth cultures that I can think of, apart from the fact that there was that terrible tragedy when that young woman was beaten to death by a sort of gang of skinheads. So it was kind of, everyone was looking down on them. So it was one of these things where I came in a bit defensive about them. And I think that's the first line, it's the decoration. My early declaration of love for them, you know.
So it's a sort of continuation of your... there is a tendency in your work to sort of speak for people on the margins and...
Yeah, it's people do it. People are, you know, unpleasant, dismissive, prejudiced in all sorts of ways. And I always think that that's one of the things that poetry does so well.
Mm.
It's a fresh look and a fresh listen. Well, I'll tell you, one of the things I like about that poem, and I don't like that much about my own poems, obviously, because you make them and you do different, but that my wife works with child and adolescent mental health, and she used to bring in that poem. Very often, a family with a withdrawn goth kid that wouldn't talk to the parents is almost the cliche of the setting she would have. They're worried about the kid, so withdrawn from family life and seems to be obsessed with these figures of death and what have you. But she would show them that poem.
Mm-hmm.
People would laugh about it, you know. And as you say, it is respectful to the goths as well. It's not laughing at them.
And I think it's difficult to come away from that poem and not sympathise with them in some way. I wonder if we could maybe finish by hearing you read that poem. That would be wonderful.
Goths. I love them. They bring a little anti-life and uncolour to the Corn Exchange on city centre shopping days, as if they had all just crawled out of that Ringu well. So many sadakos dripping tarnished silver jewellery onto the undead fashions they dig up in flea markets. They are the black that is always the new black. Their perfume lingers, freshly turned grave sweet. Black sheep, they pilgrimage twice a year to Whitby through our landscape of dissolved monastery and pit, toasting themselves in cider and blackcurrant, vegan blood. They dance macabre at gigs like the Dracula Spectacular. The next morning, love-bitten and wincing in the sunlight, they take photos of each other, hoping they won't develop.
Ian Duick. And the poems we discussed in today's podcast can be found in Ian's Blood Axe collection, The Bradford Count, and his more recent collections, The Lammas Hireling, The Speed of Dark, and Pandorama, all three published by Picador.
That was Ian Duhigg in conversation with Julia Copus. You can find out more about Ian on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 63, which was recorded by Julia Copus and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 64, Alex Martin concludes his interview with Carol Angier, discussing commissioned non-fiction, games of identity, and how he turned to crime fiction. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.